Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. TikTok says it will appeal to the Supreme Court after an appellate court upheld the law requiring TikTok to sell to a U.S.-approved owner or be shut down.
The three-judge panel shrugs off concerns expressed by China-based ByteDance of the impracticality of a sale on short notice and the effects of a ban on users. The judges instead defer to national security fears expressed by the White House and Congress, saying China is engaged in an extensive effort to gather Americans' data. If active steps aren't taken to sell the app by January 19th, the court says tens of millions of devoted TikTok users will have to find alternative media of communication.
ABC's Stephen Portnoy. New York City police say the individual suspected of gunning down UnitedHealthcare chief exec Brian Thompson is no longer in town. An Indianapolis jury deliberated about 3 hours before acquitting two police officers in the 2022 death in custody of Herman Whitfield III. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM.
Chris Middleton is back. I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It's the return of Chris Middleton to the Bucks lineup for the first time this season. Middleton explained after first injuring his left ankle, then his right last season, if that's what led to the decision to have surgery on both ankles last summer.
Yeah, directly related to each one, yeah. The doctor told me, you know, what was going on, said, you know, you could play through it if you can in the playoffs. After I took some weeks off, just realized they weren't healing the way I thought they should. Realized just needed the cleanup process to get ready for this coming season.
The Bucks are in Boston to play the Celtics. Giannis Antetokounmpo celebrating his 30th birthday today. Former teammate Drew Holiday, now with the Celtics, was asked.
Is Giannis a happy 30th birthday?
How is it? I have to tell him.
He's getting old.
NFL, the Packers back in Green Bay after losing to the Lions in Detroit 34-31. The players have the weekend off. Next Sunday night, they play the Seahawks in Seattle. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is a story of the one. As a maintenance specialist for university housing, he knows college students can major in wear and tear. Plus, housing so many students doesn't leave a lot of room to house all the supplies he needs. That's where Grainger comes in. With over a million industrial-grade products and fast, dependable delivery, Grainger carries the quality products he needs so he doesn't have to. From a new door hinge to a whole new faucet. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Hey, some good news. We in the working class, we've tightened the belt, we've sacrificed, we've given up health care and education and wage increases and standard of living so that our four richest guys, you know, Musk, Ellison, Zuckerberg, and Bezos, those guys, now worth $1 trillion. That's right. They've hit the trillion dollar mark, the four of them. Now, here's the thing. If we tighten just a little bit more, one of them one day soon, they could individually be a trillionaire. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be a sense of national honor? Wouldn't it be one of those things? We could put one of them on all the money. Because, well, they've got a lot of the money. And you go, but Rick, that's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. It's freaking ridiculous, considering just 12 years ago, those four guys were worth $74 billion. So explain to me how it is that they went from $74 billion to $1 trillion. And we didn't tax them. mind blown. And this is my tax the billionaires rant. It's time to tax the rich. It's time. Did I mention it's time to tax the rich? But that's not what's going to happen. because Republicans, oh boy, they're hell-bent on renewing Trump's tax cuts for billionaires in corporate America. Tax cuts, mind you, that experts say will actually shrink our economy and actually add $4.6 trillion to our deficit. But hey, we might get one of those guys over the top. At least we're lining the pockets of our favorite billionaires and our favorite corporate bigwigs so they can set those record profits. Another example, the rich getting richer and the working class, well, getting poorer and more beaten down. But don't fret, my working class brethren. No, no, 99-cent eggs and buck a gallon gas. You know, what you voted for? Just around the corner. Just around the corner. Trust us. Just around the corner. In fact, just keep waiting for that, like you've been waiting for that trickle. That trickle, you know, the trickle-down economics thing? You're waiting for that, right? Don't hold your breath on either side of this. And the part that bothers me is the anger that I talk to my working class brethren about, the anger that they have is not directed at the people who have been screwing them over the most. No, no. It's about people they don't even know. You know, those trans kids, we'll get them. I don't care what bathroom people go to. I care that there's food on the table, roof over their head, clothes on the kids' back, health care. Care about that. Care about real, tangible, important things for a working class person like myself, like you, like me, us. And this idea that we're going to continue to feed the rich in the hopes that someday, like manna from heaven, it'll flow. Someday, we'll get the crumbs. Because look, folks, not even the crumbs. They don't leave any of it. I saw this other story. You got this Jensen Huang, the 10th richest guy in the country, worth about $127 billion. He's not part of the four worth $1 trillion. New York Times had a report said that, you know, because of a lot of tax loopholes, a lot of tax giveaways, a lot of things that, well, Republicans have put into law for them, a lot of tax dodges, a bunch of that, this guy could avoid paying $8 billion in taxes. And you stop and you go, $8 billion in taxes, guy's worth $127 billion. Is that $8 billion really going to make or break his lunch money? I mean, really, will he not get a little extra cheese on his Whopper? I mean, seriously. But understand, it's not about what the money is, it's what the money says. It's about how much they can line their pocket with, how much they can ensure that you don't get it, that we don't get it. And as I've talked about for years, this is not a new conversation. This is not a new position I'm taking. We should be taxing these people virtually out of existence because they're not doing anything to make lives better for working people. They're making their lives better. Oh, boy. And the shareholders and the investor class around them. But the average working class person, how do we benefit from four guys being worth $1 trillion? How does that help us? Now, Elon Musk is angry over people being somewhat happy about this CEO being shot, clearly concerned for his own safety, saying basically that, you know, hey, you know, without us, you guys would all be just standing around. Really? You don't think that there are people who could fill the void? You think we would all just be standing around looking at each other? No. But instead of covering those stories, what did our mainstream media, what did our corporate-controlled mainstream media feed us? Matt Gaetz. We got to hear about Matt Gaetz. Evidently, yeah, the House Ethic Panel got together, and they talked about Matt Gaetz on Thursday, and they decided not going to release any details. Nothing. Not even. And then the House Republicans, they went and they voted, big vote, to not release any of the Gaetz report. So we don't get to know what Gaetz did. And again, this is what we're spoon-fed. Personally, I don't give a rat's behind about Matt Gaetz. I don't. Not even a little bit. What I care about the fact that we're being robbed blind. And what the right is trying to shove down our throat is, you know, it's those liberal groups are stealing from us. You know, they're getting food stamps for children. They're getting LIHEAP for old people. They're getting Section 8 housing for the poor. They're getting all these social programs. You know, a little spending, make lives a little bit better. While, I mean, it's amazing. While our billionaire class is lining their pockets like never before. And this, my friends, is the unfortunate reality in which we live in. It should be the thing that angers us. It should be the thing that drives us together. When four guys have the wealth of $1 trillion, I think wealth inequality has gone just a bit too far. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Still can't get it out of my head. Four guys, $1 trillion, the trilly. And again, you know, I keep coming back to the reality that the rich keep getting richer. And the working class, well, keep working harder, longer, and for less so that we can have these national treasures. You know, because, you know, we all should have our favorite billionaire because, hey, you know what? Our hard work, our sacrifice, our blood, sweat, tears, we created them. Now, we're not going to get the perks. You know, our kids aren't going to get great health care. They're not going to get a great education. We're not going to have good infrastructure. You know, we're still going to have people hungry and veterans homeless. Still going to have all those things. But we got four guys worth $1 trillion. And here to share some thoughts on how we get one of them. Because I think that would be a national honor. To have one guy, trillionaire, we can even make him king. I mean, he's almost halfway there anyway. Here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked my good friend Mateus Fernango to come talk with us. He's an economics professor at Bucknell University. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me, Ray.
So we could have a trillionaire, you know, soon. Look, I look at Doge Boy and what his cutting at the government. Maybe he cuts all that and puts it in his own pocket.
Well, if he cuts it, puts that out in his own pocket, he's going to have trouble because a good chunk of the money he has in his own pocket, it's from the government spending. He gets humongous amount of money in his own pocket. It is one of those things that, you know, he's not intelligent enough to know why he's rich. You know, I'm sorry to say. So part of the story is the government has been giving them, you know, tax cuts and humongous amounts of, you know, subsidies and spending and contracts and all of the things that you need to get to be a billionaire and perhaps a trillionaire. You know, Obama was right when he said, if you have all of this stuff, you didn't build it alone. You know, they didn't build it alone. He gets tons of money from the government. I doubt that they're going to have the $2 trillion cuts. Those are not happening. Exactly for that reason, because they, you know, we do have socialism in this country. This is a socialist country. It's totally a socialist country, but it's a socialist country for the very wealthy.
Yeah.
For the rest of us, It's the harsh realities of the market, and they do get socialism, and they like socialism. I mean, they tell you that they are libertarians, that they hate socialism, but the true socialists are those billionaires. They love, you know, the government, and the government that provides all the money, the tax cuts, and, you know, all the things that they need. So I don't foresee that happening, the big cuts and DOGE, which it's also not a thing. They don't even know what DOGE is. So it's just two rich guys, you know, that have the ear of the other rich guy. So it's all that's to that. So we'll see what will happen in that front.
No, I'm interested to see how it plays out, because I think Musk thinks it's serious. I think Trump gave it to him as, here, go cause some trouble. Go do some stuff on Twitter while we do all the other stuff that we want to do via Project 2025 and all of that stuff. I see it as political theater, and, you know, like the cat with the laser pointer.
It's good theater. It's good theater. It keeps people distracted. It it suggests to people that all of them could be the next Elon Musk when they have no chance of, you know, even getting, you know, a job perhaps. So that I think it's clearly, you know, part of the story. But, you know, the true intentions of the Trump administration, I think, are clear in who he put as Treasury Secretary. And it's a Wall Street conventional guy. And that says something about the incredible, and I say this with some degree of pain, what I want to say, the incredible degree of continuity that we have had for over 40 years on who we put at the Treasury.
Right.
Reagan put somebody from Wall Street, Bush put somebody from Wall Street, you know, Clinton put somebody from Wall Street, everybody, you know, the Treasury Secretary has been, you know, always someone associated with, you know, with the deep sort of interest of the financial sector in the United States, in a period in the last 40 years in which we, you know, that sector has become oversized and manufacturing and the real economy had suffered. The Republicans like to demonize George Soros because among, you know, the Wall Street people, he was a liberal and promoted causes that were seen as sort of anti-conservative in the cultural world. But the guy that he appointed to be his Treasury Secretary, or will appoint to be the Treasury Secretary, is the guy that worked with Soros in the famous, infamous sort of speculative attack on the pound in 1992. So it is, you know, a guy that was until the other day a Democrat, by the way. So on this particular issue, they're not going to touch the economy because it's exactly this that allows them to get these billionaires. So the inequality that we're suffering, that part has been something that has been entrenched in the American economy, and something that a good part of the Democratic Party has not been able or willing to touch, I'm sorry to say.
No, they've not been great on it. But are we getting the 99-cent eggs and the bucket gallon gas on January 21st? Is that coming back? At least that?
No, I think what we're getting is, you know, the things we're getting. So we're going to get tax cuts. We're going to get the regulation of the financial sector, the regulation in general. So all sorts of regulations on things like environmental issues on, you know, if you want clean water, forget about that. So in many places, you know, they're going to poison everything. But the important thing is we're going to get a bubble. The bubble is all right. So today, the Bitcoin, reach more than 100,000. So this is, you know, the crypto, you know, presidency. So we're coming with a bubble. They're going to deregulate the financial sector. They are going to cut spending. Don't get me wrong. I think DOGE will, what they'll do is they'll cut significant where they can on social programs. And so it will be felt by people. But they won't. Overall, they won't, you know, cut spending to the point that they would tank the economy. They'll be spending on other things. So they'll be giving money to the Musks. They'll be giving money to contractors in the Pentagon. So that won't stop. You know, there's too much money and too many interests associated to this. So I don't think that the predictions that Trump, I mean, there is a lot of incompetence, I should say. So maybe they're going to not intentionally tank the economy. But that's not their intention. The intention is to unleash, you know, the sort of gambling and the spending on certain sectors, which there is a lot of inefficiency, and promote the you know, cutting taxes for the very wealthy, and promote the accumulation and the, you know, benefit for a small group of people that are already incredibly wealthy. It's a kleptocracy. Trump is the representative of a kleptocracy. When he won in 2016, we talked about that. He's the first president that never divested from his interests. He was negotiating things with people inside the White House. He was opening a hotel in D.C. His kids were, you know, he was bringing foreigners, you know, foreign diplomats and authorities into his hotel with obvious problems of, you know, conflict of interest and so on and so forth. So this is a kleptocracy. This, what we're having is the government of a man that, you know, is going to use his son is now on some venture capital to cryptocurrencies. So that's what we're going to have. And this is a government of the billionaires for the billionaires by a fake billionaire.
So if they do what they say they're going to do, and I don't doubt that they're going to extend Trump's tax cuts and go down that path, the talk is it will add another $4.6 trillion to the deficit. That's kind of a big number.
It is a big number. But, you know, I'll say this. Two things that I'm less concerned than most people. So, one, I'm not that concerned that we're going to have a flare of inflation, even if they impose the tariffs, which I'm not too sure that they will. So, the incoming Treasury Secretary said that it's a tool for negotiating. So I don't think it will happen. And even if it happens, I don't think it will on the size. And even if it's the size, I don't think the inflation, we're going to have, a one-up inflation, and then it will come down as in the pandemic. So inflation is not here to stay. Inflation only stays significantly when you know, any sort of cost or increase that is passed to the consumer, the workers can sort of fight back and bring, you know, their wages up again. And that creates, you know, spirals, price-wage spirals. That's what we have in the 70s, high inflation. The working class is not strong enough, I'm sorry to say. So inflation is only a problem when your wages are losing to inflation.
Right.
The working class doesn't care if, you know, there isn't a little bit of inflation, if your wages are winning. The problem is that our wages are not winning overall. And over the last 40 years, that has stagnated. And people forget those things. So that's the problem. So one is, inflation is not our problem. Our problem is our incomes are low. That's what the working class, you know, cares about. And the second issue, the deficits. The problem is not that we're going to run deficits. I'm all for running deficits under certain circumstances. We can accumulate humongous amounts of debt. The issue is, I always tell kids, we have $30 trillion in debt, more than 100% of GDP. And people say, oh, it's humongous, we'll never pay. No, that's not true. We can't pay that. The question is, we get this humongous amount of debt. Do you get good health care? Do you get good education?
Right.
Do you hop into a good train that puts you, you know, in, you know, from D.C. to New York in an hour? No, you don't.
What do we get for it?
Yep. Through the nose, through crappy infrastructure, terrible public services, for a humongous. So you're paying taxes. You have significant debt. You're having these deficits, but you're not getting your worth. That's the thing that we should be angry. That a lot of that money will go for some project, some fake project, you know, or, you know, of whatever. He had those tunnels to suck people that instead of having, you know, fast trains that we could have had. And he used that only to, you know, to delay the actual, you know, development of technologies that, you know, are simple to get. Anybody has. China has. China's a low middle-income country. China has good trains. You know what I mean? Why can't we have good trains? Why can we not spend significant amount of money, not promise and which, you know, again, I should say, Biden was very good in pushing an agenda that for the first time really was spending money on things like climate change. But a lot of that was compensated. I mean, you know, if you spend, I match that. No, we should go out and do it. A Green New Deal in the sense of the New Deal, that we go out and build this stuff. We can't build stuff anymore. We can do stuff. And that part is, I think, concerning. So we're not going to do that. We're going to have four terrible years, and I don't want to even to think of the things that I'm not a specialist, you know, in health with Kennedy, with Robert Kennedy, you know, in immigration issues. All of those issues will come to the fore. The only thing I'll say is that he'll make so many blunders, and I think he'll make blunders in the economy too, that this will backfire. The question is whether Democrats are willing to make the decisions that are necessary to, when they take over at some point, change the direction so that we don't keep this economy with trillionaires and homeless.
No, look, I've been saying for a long time, the anger was real. The anger is real.
Yes.
And Trump is not going to make people's lives better. There's no policy that I've seen that's going to make the working class have better opportunities, better lives, better standard of living. I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing tax cuts for rich people, tax cuts for corporations, deregulation. I'm seeing all of this stuff to feed the CEO class while sticking it to the working people. And Democrats had better pay attention and figure out a message that's going to move that anger in a direction that makes those people's lives better and wants them to vote for Democrats and for smart policy.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. So the problem that the Republican Party has is that they cannot be at the same time the party of the plutocrats and billionaires and the party of the angry of the working class people. But
they're trying though, Mateus. I mean, if you've been paying attention to the right-wing media sphere in this country, man, you would think the GOP was, they were out there, marching in the streets with those working people going, we deserve better wages. You'd think that they were the working class.
I know. Well, the working class, I mean, it was a protest vote. I mean, the biggest protest, the number one vote was for nobody. I would say in this country, so Biden actually in 2020 got more votes than the no votes. Trump was third in 2020. It was Biden, no votes, then Trump. But if you want to go back at a period in which you had again that the victory was we voted for somebody, you have to go, if I'm not wrong, you have to go all the way back to Lyndon Johnson. Because no votes win all the time. So the great protest is the amount of people that decided that between these two, I'm not going to vote. Why? Because they're both allowing. And again, I don't completely agree. I did go vote for Biden. I do think that it was positive for working class. He did many things that were relevant. Having said that, there is an actual anger because certain things didn't sort of work out. So I think that I think at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. The Democratic Party either sort of shifts left, or we're going to have significant problems because the Republican Party and their media machine is very capable of channeling some of the anger of working class people, enough of the working class people, in the direction of the disaster that we're going to have.
Well, I think a big part of that is I've talked to a lot of my working class friends who believe that they're middle class. And I know there's a distinction there, but I try and explain to them, no, you cash a paycheck every week. That paycheck doesn't seem to go as far as it used to. You're struggling to put food on the table, roof over your head. That to me is not a middle class existence. That's a working class existence. And for me, there is a difference. At least I think there is.
I'll say this. I don't remember who said that, but I think that the very idea of a middle class is a wedge to divide the working class. There is only working class, so some in the working class are better off. But if you get a paycheck, you're working class. You're not. Some people can be bought, sure. Don't get me wrong. So a good chunk in the working class, the so-called upper middle class, whatever, they're doing well enough that they can be bought and think that they have no class consciousness. But that doesn't mean that they're not working class. So if you have to work in order to put food on the table, you're working class. If you can live from your trust fund, then I'll give you. You're not working class. That's as simple as that. In my book, that's the only serious relevant distinction that we have. And the problem is that we haven't been able. And again, it's by design in many ways. The labor movement at some point did think whether there should be there were talks in the 50s and 60s of whether there should be a Labour Party in the United States. And the decision was always that, you know, you fight it within the Democratic Party. But, you know, it's been a losing proposition. And so in many ways. And so I think that it's something that we're getting to a point, I think, in which those issues will become life of death for the Democratic Party. So I don't think that the Democratic Party can survive if it's not capable of regaining the trust of the working class.
No, I'm right there with you. Right there with you. Mateus, always great talking with you. I appreciate the input, the thoughts, and we'll see how this plays out over the next four very, very long years. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Our good friend Mateus Vernengo. I want to hear your thoughts. What are you expecting in the coming year? What kind of an economy can we plan to see? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. What are you thinking? Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. This is The Rick Smith Show.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Tonight, a mostly clear sky, a low in the low 20s. With sunshine for tomorrow, it'll warm up into the low 40s for a high. Increasing clouds for Sunday, a high around 40, chance of showers Sunday night. Currently, it's 26.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Harvey K., Professor Emeritus of Democracy. We're talking about the Act 10 overturned by a Dane County judge.
I think it's important for everyone to know that this was the state that in 1959 first granted public employees the right to organize and bargain collectively. We have a lot to take back. You know, I used to say take back America, but I say take back Wisconsin.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are AFGE.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I think everyone who sent emails over the last couple of days on our health situation, thank you. Appreciate it. Also, some of the emails I got from folks on the shooting of the United Health CEO caught my attention. Look, most people, vast majority, well, everyone except one, was on the side of, you know, I understand. I'm with you, Rick. Don't condone it. It's wrong. But I understand. And this was my position, and I stand by it. I've said... I don't condone it, but I can't condemn it. So when I got this email saying, I heard you say you can't condemn someone who's been murdered by another human being, what's wrong with you? My mind went, well, I do understand. I understand that the pain and misery that people feel. I get it. This person who emailed me, and again, this is the weird thing. It's the thing that bothers me about people today. It's one of those things that's bothered me for a long time, and I've brought this up in the past. If you're going to disagree with me, if you're going to use all kinds of colorful language and throw, you know, barbs and accusations, at least sign your name. At least put a phone number. I'm happy to call you and have a conversation. Because I've done that. I've done it numerous times over the years. But he goes on to say, typical of liberals to justify violent criminal behavior when it suits your agenda. He says, you have no idea what happened, and yet you shoot off your big mouth, and then went into a whole bunch of stuff, you know, to kind of feed and reiterate that name-calling and, you know, a whole bunch of stuff I don't have time for. Look, I said, if you watched the show yesterday, I said, I don't know what happened. I can guess, especially now that we hear that on the shell casings, were the words denial, defend, and depose. That, I don't know, kind of a clue. And look, I don't. I'm going to say I still don't know. And we may not know. They may not catch this person. I know there's a lot of people who hope they don't. I'm of the mindset if they catch him, I think self-defense could be part of it. Now, I don't justify violent crime. And I said from the beginning, I don't condone it. But I do understand. And like I said, I've never heard from this person before. At least I don't recognize the email. You know, so it's odd to me to have a working class person who's going to take time to write in defense of a CEO. Because as I said, I've seen so many stories about this CEO getting killed. Every news outlet, every website, everybody's got a story. Everybody's in for the manhunt. Everywhere you look, there's a story and reward for the capture and conviction of the evil doer. And look, great. But I got to ask the question. This is the other side of that coin. How many stories did you hear yesterday, today? How many will we hear tomorrow about people who died because insurance companies denied care or the medical establishment practiced insurance we're practicing insurance company medicine. You know, we think the insurance company is going to deny it, so we're not going to even try. Now, what's interesting is we've now found out through a lot of people doing some research, United Healthcare had like a 32% denial rate. Highest in the industry. The leader, the tippy top. Anthem only had a 23% denial rate. And they're the people who... they had the bright idea about a month ago to claim that they're not going to pay anesthesiologists for the entire surgery. So it's one of those things you go, wait a second. So the anesthesiologist only works half the surgery? What about the other half? Or, oh, he only gets paid for it. So you're trying to stiff the anesthesiologist. Wait a second. I got questions. What happened to the doctor? And my problem with all this, and in no-name emailer, where I understand, and this is where, because more intimately now than I ever have in my entire life, is the medical establishment. Even when the big bad insurance companies aren't breathing down their neck, even when the insurance companies aren't denying, you've got doctors who are saying, well, you know, it's what the insurance company would allow. They've got these metrics that are put in place to not even try. And I'll give you an example. This is the situation that I am in. My wife was in a motorcycle accident back on September 12th. We have gone through every bit of medical positioning you can. We went from the intensive care to a step down intensive care, now to a rehab hospital. We're doing all of these different doctors and experts and all this stuff. And my insurance, and I've said this before, I am extraordinarily privileged. They haven't questioned a thing. Nothing. They have paid every bill. They have denied nothing. And will deny nothing because I don't have an insurance company. I have a health and welfare fund. My Teamsters Union, the Central Pennsylvania Teamsters Health and Welfare Fund, is a fund. They don't act as necessarily as an insurance company. They do buy an insurance company's list to be able to pay the same rates that a big behemoth like Anthem or one of these other ones would pay. So some people could easily go, well, you've got that kind of coverage. And the reality is they don't. The doctor that is my wife's main doctor at the rehab hospital can't seem to get it through his head that there are no insurance company constraints, that he can practice medicine, that he can be the doctor that he probably wanted to be when he started. He can give my wife the opportunity to thrive in this rehab hospital. Now, the argument, well, she's plateaued. because for 2 weeks they've been fighting infections and they've been, you know, chasing bugs all over the place, and it's wiped her out. But this doctor is still hell bent on discharging her in several days, even though she's incapable of standing, sitting, feeding herself, anything, any normal function, she's incapable of doing right now. Now she's working towards it. She's progressing, I believe, and getting strength back and doing other things, which is why you go to a rehab hospital. That's why you go to rehab, to get better, to rehabilitate, to get stronger. And yet, this doctor, without the constraints of an insurance company over them, still trying to hide behind the insurance company because of the outweighed power that insurers have in training doctors. And understand, the people who made these denials weren't the CEOs, they weren't the executives, they were doctors. These are people who took that Hippocratic Oath, or as some are saying, a hypocritical oath, because they're now getting paid to find reasons to deny. So when I say I don't condone the behavior, but I understand it, I now more intimately than ever understand the anger that one could have. My wife is still here. She's still, I believe, progressing. You know, a perfect example. And it was a moment. I said to her, I said, look, the doctor says we need to step it up in therapy. We need to answer questions. We need to be aware. We need to focus. We need to try and do the best we can. And I said, you know, we're going to get through this. And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, together, like we always do. And I got to tell you, it grabbed me by the heart. Because in that moment, she was there. In that moment, she understood what I was telling her. In that moment, she got it. And I got a text a couple hours later from my daughter. And this is why, you know, I'm fighting so hard to get her, as any of us would do. My daughter texts me later and says, she just told the nurse that she wants to take a look at the therapy schedule so she can get up early, so she can be ready for therapy in the morning. That, I got to tell you, joy from my heart. Joy. Because something clicked. Now, does this mean she's going to get better? I don't know. Yeah, we still don't know. We don't know what... As I've said, you know, her bones will heal, her muscles will strengthen, she will live. I don't know what that life is going to be, because a lot of times she's not there. But she's getting more of these moments. And for me, if I were a doctor, and this is where I come back to this, if I were the doctor, and maybe it's just because it's my loved one, I don't think so. If there are no constraints, if there is no one telling you no, you do what's in the best interest of the patient. Because the weird thing is as I am talking to this doctor and I am pleading, and I am pleading my case, he agrees the facility that she is in is the best facility for her to be in. It's the best place for her. He agrees. And that's the weird part of this. And this is, again, another one of these situations where, as a working class guy, I'm a truck driver. I think of what's normal, what's natural, what's logical, what's rational. And when a doctor says this is the best place for her while simultaneously saying, I'm throwing her out, I can't fathom how you can hold both positions at the same time, unless there's something there that I don't know. And this, again, is where my frustration is. And so you go, you know, how could you not condemn this shooter? I got to tell you right now, in my heart, I am angry. If she were to die because they denied her care, I would be much more angry. And I don't know at that moment. I don't think any of us really know. And again, I don't condone it. And I'm not saying it's what I would do, but I kind of understand it. And I understand it a lot more intimately right now. And I've had to do things and say things and make statements throughout this, as a lot of you have sent your stories to me. And thank you, because they've been immensely helpful. And I hope by telling those stories, it helps make it a little bit better for you as well. By sharing your experience, trying to help me, and I appreciate it immensely. I hope it's helpful back, because a lot of you took a lot of time writing, you know, very long, meticulously written emails. But I'll give you another story, and this is where I'll leave this for today. We went in for surgery last week to get some work done on her arm. And her arm is the good arm, quote unquote good arm, is basically worthless to find blood. All the veins are blown out, and it's impossible to get a stick to get blood out. And to put an IV in, forget it. So they had four people came in, looked at it, couldn't find anything. They brought in an anesthesiologist who, after like 45 minutes, was able to find something, you know, in the top, between the knuckles on the top of the hand. And at the end of the surgery and the recovery, I noticed that there's the IV in there. And I go, hey, they were talking about maybe doing an IV drip to deal with one of the infections. Let me call over and see if we can keep that in, because they might need it. So I called over and, you know, tell them what I want. And they said, we'll get back to you. So in the interim, a nurse comes in and says, I got to take that out. I said, well, you know, if you could hold off a minute, I've called over to the other hospital. They might need that. And she's like, no, she can't be discharged with this. Cannot happen. Under no circumstances. And I'm like, whoa, hold on. We're going to find out if they need it, because I explained, she's got all these problems. It's a miracle that they found it. It would be enormously beneficial for her if you were to leave that in place. It would be enormously beneficial for her. It would be in her best interest if you would please leave it right where it is. And she looked at me and gave me this kind of, and proceeded to move forward to take it out. And I said, if you take that out, I will break both your arms. Now, am I proud of that? No, I'm not. It's the truck driver in me coming out, the ghetto kid in me coming out, and I regretted it. You know what happened next? lots of people. But in the interim, the hospital calls and says, that's all right, we're not going to use that. I don't know what happened to make that decision. They just did. We tapped down that situation. Here a week later, they have to put a PICC line in, into her heart to get an IV in. And I go, you know, had we just done what was in her interest at the beginning, maybe we wouldn't be here. And a lot of what medicine seems to me to have turned into, and this is the sad reality, we're running hospitals with temp employees, everyone's hiding behind policies and hiding behind insurance companies, hiding behind, well, this is what we do, as opposed to what's in the best interest of the patient. I have real problems where we are. But I want to hear yours. Please continue to send them. I want to hear what your thoughts are. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1869. That was the day black workers met in Washington, D.C. to found the Colored National Labor Union. 214 black trade unionists hoped to work toward equal representation in the workforce. They also demanded anti-discrimination legislation, federally funded education, and the fulfillment of the promise of 40 acres and a mule for Southern farmers. 34-year-old black caulker Isaac Myers was elected the organization's first president. He had organized black caulkers in the Chesapeake shipyards. Myers hoped to lead black workers into the National Labor Union, an early effort at building a national labor movement. National Labor Union founder William Silvis insisted there should not be distinction of race or nationality among the ranks. Myers added that white and black workers must come together in solidarity and organize for higher wages and living standards. Many members of the National Labor Union were not so progressive when it came to integrated unions. Some of these organizations had whites-only clauses in their bylaws. Others feared competition from black workers and voted not to extend membership. Myers understood the need to organize black workers. While the National Labor Union did not live up to its stated ideal of inclusion, Myers' efforts welcomed all workers regardless of race, gender, or occupation, and represented workers across 21 states. They were soon met with the full weight of resistance that hostile bosses, media, and the government brought down upon them when they tried to push for reforms of any kind. Though the Colored National Labor Union soon fell into decline, black workers carried on its ideals of interracial solidarity during the Great Strikes of 1877. So did the new Knights of Labor, who insisted an injury to one is an injury to all.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So how many of you have seen the Gen X kind of, our childhood was so great? And look, as a Gen Xer, our childhood was pretty good. Look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and as poor as we were, my childhood was pretty good. Morning, as soon as the sun came up, till the streetlights came on, we were out playing, we were out running around, playing football, baseball. We had a whole gang of kids that we played with. It was great. We had great adventures. We did great things. But we see this meme flying around all the time. And I just happened to, I think I'm tired of it now. I had someone send it to me and said, you should repost this as a Gen Xer. And I'm like, I don't know. Look, you go back and you think about your childhood and you always think about it in terms of, wow, it was the greatest ever and so much better. Every generation does this. We had it so good. We had it so much better than this generation. These kids don't know what it's like. And understand, you know, part of me goes, yeah, look, you know, eating popsicles was a treat on a hot day. Absolutely. If you went to the corner store, had a buck in your pocket when I was a kid, you were rich. You could load up for the day. The idea that, the phone was on the wall and had a cord that never ended. You hear all of this stuff, the games we played, the kind of things we did, just amazing. You know, children were seen and not heard. You know, staying in the house was a punishment. And the only thing we knew about being bored is you better find something to do before I find it for you. We ate what mom made, or we ate nothing at all. You know, that kind of, there was no bottled water. We drank from the tap or from the hose because you weren't allowed in the house. Saturday morning was about cartoons and cereal. Read the box, rode our bikes. If you heard your first and last name, you better run quickly. We were afraid of nothing, this thing says. We watched our mouths around our elders because we better show respect or else we were in deep trouble. These were the good old days. Kids today, they'll never know. They'll never know what it feels like to be a real kid. They'll never understand. And look, I do. I think our childhood was great. You know, the difference was, and I love these jingoistic kind of things that they throw out here about how wonderful everything was. But I look at us now, and I think back to, you know, my generation as a kid, we took on bullies. We didn't vote for him. We stood up to injustice. We stood up for the kid on the playground who was getting bullied. We never kicked anyone when they were down. We'd fight like cats and dogs, and then 5 minutes later, we're friends with the person that we were just beating the tar out of. We were taught to live by the golden rule. And we did. If somebody came to the school and didn't have their lunch, we shared. How did we get where we are today? And look, Gen X is the generation that put Donald Trump in the White House. How did we go from this great childhood of community thinking, of having a lot of friends and doing a lot of things as a group and as a community? How did we become this self-centered, angry group that is never satisfied? How did we get there? Because, you know, as I was reading through this thing, I'm going, I got to tell you, the person who posted it, I know, and I'm like, I got to tell you, I think the 10-year-old version of us would be kicking the tar out of us right now, because we are better. We were better than what we are now. Now, I know it was a different world. It was a different time. We had different values. The community was different. But was it? We had all of the same kind of pressures that you see today. It just wasn't magnified by right-wing media. Yes, we had transvestites. We had those. They were there. But was it the bane of our existence? Was it was shoved down our throats at every... No, we didn't know any better. We left it alone. Didn't care. We had people of the LGBTQ community. Didn't care. They led their lives. And in turn, they left us alone. Let us to lead our lives. So as I thought of this, and I'm looking at this, I'm going, you know, with all the ways the wealth class has sliced and diced and divided us, you know, this meme, this email, this how wonderful our childhood is an opportunity to go, yeah, it was pretty great. It was. For me, it was pretty great. I had friends of every ethnicity, and we didn't lead with it. In fact, we mocked each other over it. We were tolerant of each other, and tolerant of people who were different than us. The sad reality is where we are is, you know, everyone talks about tolerance, but nobody seems to want to understand what that means. It means in order to have someone be tolerant to you, you have to be tolerant back to them. And I don't know that we're there. So again, like when I saw this, you know, my mind goes, how can we use this wonderful childhood that we all... Everyone in my generation looks back on and goes, ah, those are the good days. How can we take that experience and make life better? Because understand, if you're mocking Gen X, if you're mocking the millennials, them's your kids. You done it. If you're mocking Gen Z, them's your grandkids. You done it. You can't go, No. It's you, buddy. So, and I can't wait to hear people, you know, chime in on this, because I do think we need to take some responsibility, because we were that generation. We were the generation that was, you know, let out to go run wild. We were feral. We were, what do they call them now? Free range kids. Didn't know there was a name for it. Had a latch key. You know, in fact, you know, climbed through the window a lot of times because I'd lose the key. But how do we take these memories? How do we take this sense of pride and move that forward? Instead of using this as something that divides us and tears us apart and separates us, how do we use those memories, those experiences, those opportunities? How do we use that to make life better? This is my call to my generation. This is my call to Gen X. How about doing something that's going to make someone's life better instead of trying to just make things worse and just being angry and slamming your fist on the table? How about that? Can we get a little of that? Can we give that a try? And the next time you send me one of these stupid memes, at least have it somewhat well-rounded with the reality of, yeah, we had a great childhood, but we did good things too because we were good kids. Want to hear your thoughts, obviously. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Anything I said make you think, make you angry, make you sad, make you mad, I want to hear it. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Miss any of the program podcast, freespeech.org. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News.